This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Jackie Leonard, and at 14 hours GMT on Tuesday, the 21st of January, these are our main stories. In an address to the World Economic Forum in Davos, President Trump has described environmental campaigners as prophets of doom. France has agreed to delay the implementation of its new tax on the big technology companies after talks between President Macron and Mr. Trump. And Chinese leaders are warning against any cover-ups as they try to contain the spread of the new respiratory virus. Also in this podcast,
there are plenty of artefacts already recovered which create an enormous amount of interest and indeed exhibitions. I sincerely hope that this new US-UK charter does prevent that from happening.
Lying at the bottom of the Atlantic Ocean, efforts are being made to protect the remaining wreck of the Titanic. President Trump has strongly criticised environmental campaigners at a meeting of the World Economic Forum in Switzerland, describing them as prophets of doom. Climate change is one of the central themes of the forum being held in Davos. But in his opening speech, Mr. Trump provided a counter-narrative to calls that the world was facing an environmental catastrophe.
To embrace the possibilities of tomorrow, we must reject the perennial prophets of doom and their predictions of the apocalypse. They are the heirs of yesterday's foolish fortune tellers, and I have them, and you have them, and we all have them. And they want to see us do badly, but we don't let that happen.
So who could he be talking about? Well, among those attending is, of course, the Swedish teenage activist Greta Thunberg. Speaking after Mr. Trump, she lambasted the complacency of those doing too little.
Any plan or policy of yours that doesn't include radical emission cuts at the source, starting today, is completely insufficient. No political ideology or economic structure has been able to tackle the climate and environmental emergency and create a cohesive and sustainable world. Because that world, in case you haven't noticed, is currently on fire.
President Trump has been critical for a long time of efforts to tackle climate change. So was his address as expected? Our correspondent Sally Bundock was listening in Davos.
Absolutely on message. I mean, as he went into the Congress Centre and before he addressed global leaders earlier today, he did say to one journalist who kind of probed him, and he said, I'm into climate, he said, as he went to the stage. But when it came to his speech addressing delegates here at the World Economic Forum, where climate change this year is the focal point, he hardly touched on it at all. He just made the mention of not listening to the apocalyptic prophecies that some are saying, that the doomsayers, he says, the pessimistic views that are out there. So he made a bit of a candid reference to the issues of the climate crisis. He also said the US will join the 1 trillion trees initiative being announced here this week, something the World Economic Forum has announced. But it's quite interesting. You mentioned Greta was speaking shortly after the president, and she said in her speech, planting trees is good, but nowhere near enough what is needed. So you had two extremely contrasting speeches. They're both at the opposite ends of the spectrum on this issue that's dominating the forum this year.
And in his rejection of environmental activism, is Mr. Trump likely to find a receptive audience in Davos? Is he likely to be swaying businesses or other countries?
Well, it's quite interesting because, of course, yesterday we had the International Monetary Fund predict that actually they believe the global growth picture for this year and next is worse than they previously thought. So they've downgraded their growth forecast. And for global leaders here and chief executives, I think they're thinking they've got to tackle more immediate challenges of restoring growth, restoring confidence, rather than focusing on how to address climate change. You know, the economic fragility that sort of is ahead, especially with trade tensions still very much at the fore, despite what President Trump had to say today about that incidentally. But I think for global leaders, they're very much feeling they've been in a very uncertain place for quite some time. Last year, 2019, we saw the worst global economic growth for more than a decade. So although there is a lot of talk here about climate change, we'll have to yet see what action follows.
That was Sally Bundock in the Swiss ski resort of Davos. Well, China uses almost as much coal as the rest of the world put together, but at the same time is a world leader in wind and solar production. According to the International Energy Agency, between 2019 and 2024, China will account for 40% of the global expansion in renewable energy. However, it is now reopening some suspended coal mines so it can increase the amount of electricity it can generate. In a speech late last year, the country's premier, Li Keqiang, urged energy officials to promote coal-fired power. Our China correspondent, Robin Brandt, reports from Inner Mongolia.
Through the gate, out to where the goats and chickens are. It's minus 15 here, and the snow on the ground isn't going anywhere. Li has lived and farmed on the old frontier in China's north for all of her 54 years. In the depths of winter, staying warm is her number one priority. All she's known is coal, but the pile she is shoveling by the chicken coop has depleted and the old green coal stove has been moved outside. It's rusting.
I put the wood or the old corn cobs inside here and the coal here, and the heat comes from here.
Life changed a few months ago when Li's house got gas. No more coal or dried corn cobs to heat her home. She is one of millions that China is moving to what it hopes is a greener life.
I'm going to ask her to show you how she turns it on. Oh, OK. Oh, you don't know?
There are vast reserves of coal under our feet in this part of China, and it's a nation struggling to wean itself off of a decades-long addiction.
If they don't give us the subsidy, we will burn our coal to use for heating again. Just forget it. Gas is just too expensive. We are old. How can we afford gas?
China's challenge is encapsulated by that white box on the wall in the corner of the kitchen inside there. How does this country wean itself off of a resource that certainly here is still so plentiful? Coal is cheap, it's reliable, and this is crucial, there are still plenty of Chinese jobs involved in the industry. Around half the coal that's burned across the world in a year is burned here in China. At this facility in Inner Mongolia, coal from dozens of mines is dumped, processed, and then shipped off. I was told that business used to be better here. China has succeeded in cutting back on coal, but things are changing. The country is now expanding its coal mining capacity. It's reversed the trend of recent years, and it's started to increase construction of coal-fired power stations. It's coal that powered China from communist revolution to consumerism. But economic growth here is now slowing, so the government's trying to cushion the impact and protect millions of jobs. It's spending, or rather building, on new apartments, new railway lines, new metro networks. And that means falling back on coal. Professor Bo Chenglin explains.
The last year, particularly 2018, the substantial increase in energy demand, I believe electricity is about 8.5%. We haven't seen it for a long time.
Professor Lin is an academic and advisor to China's National Energy Commission.
The renewables, wind and solar, together with the nuclear alone, is less than 6%. When electricity demand and energy demand are high, then the renewables cannot satisfy the demand at the same time to replace the coal.
A decade ago, coal accounted for 72% of China's energy mix. That's now down to 58%. But overall, the country's CO2 emissions from fossil fuels are still going up. And that means China's expected to be responsible for effectively all the increase in global CO2 emissions in 2019.
That report by Robin Brandt in the Chinese autonomous region of Inner Mongolia. In other news, French officials say the government has agreed to delay the collection of taxes from US digital service providers until the end of the year. A French government official told the BBC that in return, the United States wouldn't impose any retaliatory tariffs on French goods. Andrew Walker reports.
Many countries want the big technology companies to pay more tax, and there is an international effort underway in the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development to change global rules. But some, including France, had become impatient. Paris introduced a new tax last year on the revenue those companies make from providing services to users in France. President Trump was outraged and argued that it discriminated against American firms. He threatened new tariffs on a range of French goods, including champagne and cheese. President Macron has averted the retaliation for now by agreeing to delay collecting the tax.
Andrew Walker. China's top leaders have warned officials that they will not tolerate any cover-up in the battle to contain a respiratory virus that's already infected nearly 300 people. State media say so far there have been 6 fatalities. The emergency comes as hundreds of millions of Chinese people begin travelling within China and abroad to celebrate the Lunar New Year. Stringent health checks have been imposed inside the country. Beijing says the virus can be transmitted from person to person. At a Shanghai railway station, these travellers spoke about their concerns.
Of course I am worried. I just went to buy masks. I tried to buy masks around my neighbourhood before leaving, but they were all sold out.
I'm worried that the virus may spread further all of a sudden. And if cross-infection happens during this travel period, the epidemic will be terrible.
The virus was first identified in the central Chinese city of Wuhan. Chinese state media said the authorities there were shutting down markets and urging the cancellation of unnecessary public gatherings. Our correspondent in Beijing is Stephen McDonnell.
They're already putting measures in place in Beijing and every city in China, and that's because millions of people are already moving around China as we lead up to the new year, and for the next several weeks, there'll be hundreds of millions of people not only travelling around China, but overseas, and it's why the authorities are so worried about the potential for this virus to spread, given that scientists seem to have established that it can, more easily than they thought, jump from person to person. And where the most drastic measures are being taken, it's in Wuhan, the city where it all started. For example, the authorities there are suggesting that anybody with a high temperature doesn't leave this city of 11 million people. The government has said that local tour groups are not allowed to go, not allowed to leave Wuhan. And as cars drive away, they're being pulled over randomly and officials are checking people with temperatures. These are all kind of drastic sounding measures, but it's because it is such a potentially serious matter. Now we have nearly 300 people infected, 6 people dead, but scientists, especially those in Hong Kong and Britain, are the ones who've spoken out the sort of with the loudest voices here, are estimating that it could be thousands already infected rather than hundreds.
And what have the authorities learned about this particular outbreak, this particular strain of the virus?
Well, so initially it came from a seafood market where there are other animals there, and they're thinking it's jumped from animals to humans. In the early days, there was some hope that maybe it wouldn't so easily be passed from person to person because there didn't seem to be too many medical staff treating these people getting sick. Well, now we have 14 medical staff, I guess doctors and nurses, who have pneumonia, and that's what this coronavirus causes. That's what kills people, is the pneumonia. And there have also been some cases in Guangdong where it seems to have gone from person to person rather than the majority of people who've all come from Wuhan. So it did, that was the hope, that it was only those who've been in Wuhan who'd been exposed. But now it is becoming much more serious. For example, Australia's become the latest country to be screening all passengers coming out of Wuhan. There's a man there who's in isolation, who has a virus, who's come from Wuhan. They're thinking it could be the coronavirus. In the Philippines, there's a child they're also monitoring with the virus who's come out of Wuhan. Vietnam, Japan, South Korea all have screening sections in place. So the worry is this could get worse before it gets better.
That was Stephen McDonnell in Beijing. And as he was saying, the Australian authorities have confirmed that one man is in isolation and is being tested for the coronavirus. He had returned to Australia from visiting family in Wuhan, China, when he began to develop respiratory problems. Queensland's chief medical officer is Dr. Jeanette Young.
We've got one gentleman that we're just following at the moment who has travelled to Wuhan and has developed a respiratory illness, but he's recovering at home, and so we've done some tests on him and we're awaiting results.
Rania McIntyre is an expert on emerging infectious diseases and head of the biosecurity program at the Kirby Institute in Sydney. She spoke to Claire McDonnell.
So it seems like it's a new virus that hasn't affected humans in the past. It may have been present in animals in the past, but we never knew about it. And that seems to have been the case with the related viruses, SARS and MERS coronavirus. It seems to be more severe than the usual coronaviruses, which generally cause a common cold type syndrome. So it's more like SARS and MERS coronavirus in that it's causing pneumonia and some deaths, although the death rate appears to be lower than with SARS.
In a sense, how do we know until it actually transfers to a human what we are dealing with? How can we track these viruses? Is there any way before that happens?
Yes, we can test animals that we know are hosts for viruses like this. So in the past, we've identified bats, cats, civet cats, camels in Saudi Arabia as hosts for these coronaviruses. So you can certainly do animal studies and track the emergence of these viruses that way. But more commonly, we find out about it when such viruses make the jump from one species to humans to another and cause infection in humans.
And when these viruses hit human biology, what can be done? As we're hearing, you know, they are creating pneumonia in certain patients. But is that all you can do? You can hospitalise people and treat them for the symptoms, but very little else?
At this stage, yes, we don't have a drug or a vaccine, although I know that there has been a vaccine in development for MERS coronavirus. Whether it will have any cross-protection for this virus, I don't know. But supportive care can, you know, save people's lives, particularly if they've got severe respiratory distress and can't breathe. Have been ventilated, being in ICU, etc., can be a life-saving measure.
Rania McIntyre from the Kirby Institute in Australia. It struck an iceberg on its maiden voyage in 1912, and the Titanic, once considered unsinkable, now lies at the bottom of the Atlantic, nearly 4,000 metres down. It's in international waters, about 370 nautical miles south of Newfoundland in Canada. The continuing interest in the ship has led to pillaging and souvenir hunting. Now an international agreement is in place to protect what's left of it. Terry Egan reports.
Since it was found in 1985, the wreck of the Titanic has endured dozens of expeditions to its hull. The ship has suffered serious damage from mini-submarines landing on its surface. It's also being consumed by the ocean floor, its metal destroyed by bacteria. Worse, since it was discovered, thousands of artefacts have been pulled up. Eyeglasses, sections of the hull, a silver pocket watch stopped at the very moment one victim fell into the icy waters. In 2008, a life jacket said to have been taken from a floating victim sold for $53,000. The chairman of the British Titanic Society is David Scott Bedard.
There are plenty of artefacts already recovered which create an enormous amount of interest and indeed exhibitions. I sincerely hope that this new US-UK charter does prevent that from happening.
The wreck has previously been given a basic level of protection by UNESCO, the Cultural Organization of the United Nations. But this treaty between the US and the UK marks the first time it's been covered by explicit legislation. It gives the two countries the power to grant or deny permits to visit the wreck and to remove artefacts from outside it. The UK's Maritime Minister, Nusrat Ghani, said the treaty meant the wreck would now be treated with the sensitivity and respect owed to the final resting place of more than 1,500 lives. And yet, the travails of the Titanic may not be over. While Canada and France were involved in the negotiations, they've not signed the agreement. And this is still just the first step in the efforts of numerous countries to protect the remains.
That report by Terry Egan. Still to come in this podcast.
That storm will have washed some of the mud away. Let's go and have a look and see what we can find.
So what did the man, along with his two dogs, find on a beach in southwest England? More later. Now, we heard earlier from President Trump in Davos in Switzerland. But in Washington, some 6,700 kilometres away from the snow-capped mountains, roughly, lawyers for President Trump and the Democrat impeachment managers have been making final preparations for his historic trial in the Senate. It begins later on Tuesday. Justin Webb has been speaking to our North America editor, John Sopel, about what will happen today.
Mitch McConnell, who is the Senate majority leader, the Republican leader in the Senate, has set out the rules of the road. And what he is proposing is essentially a process that could mean that this whole much vaunted trial that everyone has been waiting for could be done and dusted within a week. Because what he's saying is, he said, look, right, you Democrats, you've got 24 hours to set out your case over 2 days. Republicans or the Trump defense team, you've got 2 days to set out your defense. We could have some questions. Then we'll have a vote on whether we take witnesses. And if there are no witnesses, then, right, let's get it all over and done with.
Right. And tell us about the vote on witnesses, because that is important.
This is crucial. There are a whole pile of people that the Democrats would like to hear from. So, for example, the former National Security Advisor, John Bolton. Previous witnesses have testified that John Bolton thought that what was going on with the president's lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, operating this back channel to Ukraine was highly irregular, a drug deal, he called it. He described Rudy Giuliani as a hand grenade that is going to blow us all up. So it seems understandable that Democrats would want to hear what testimony John Bolton wants to bring. The Republicans don't want to open this up because they think it prolongs matters. And there will be a critical vote which will require a simple majority. At the moment, the Republicans have 53 Senate members, the Democrats 47. So it requires four Republicans to change their minds. And there are four Republicans who think it will be strange to go ahead with a vote on a trial without hearing from witnesses.
John Sopel in Washington. The Constitutional Court in Thailand has ruled against dissolving one of the country's largest opposition parties after it was accused of opposing the monarchy and of being influenced by a secret international conspiracy. A conviction could have seen Future Forward banned from Thai politics. Jonathan Head reports.
There were cheers from supporters of Future Forward at the party headquarters as the judges of the Constitutional Court read out their verdict. Some called for Prime Minister Prayut Chan-o-cha to resign. The court has a track record of dissolving dissident political parties on seemingly trivial grounds. But the bizarre accusation this time that Future Forward was allied to a mythical secret society known as the Illuminati in a campaign against the monarchy was judged too flimsy to warrant such punishment this time. But the party and its executives still face more than 20 other legal cases that could yet result in its dissolution. Its youthful and charismatic founder and leader, Thanaton Jongrungrungkit, a wealthy businessman, is viewed as a dangerous subversive by many conservative Thais. Earlier this month, he joined a nationwide run to protest against General Prayut's continued hold on power after last year's election. Mr. Thanaton has promised to lead more protests if his party is dissolved.
That was Jonathan Head. Medical experts in Britain have recommended the legalisation of sperm donations after death. The scientists said posthumous sperm donation was technically feasible and would help to meet the growing demand from couples seeking fertility treatment. However, they acknowledge that posthumous donation would raise concerns about consent and family permission. Dan Damon spoke to one of the authors of the report, Dr. Joshua Parker from the northwest of England, and to the Australian medical ethicist, Dr. Leslie Canold. First, Dr. Parker.
Essentially, we've written this paper in the Journal of Medical Ethics that argues that it would be morally permissible for us to take sperm from men who've died and allow it to be used in fertility clinics. There's been a steady trickle of cases where men have died and sperm's been used successfully to create offspring, typically in a known relationship, you know, by, say, the partner or the wife. The other thought is that there is a shortage of donor sperm in the UK, and there's a shortage of kind of the variety of characteristics that donors have as well. And so it was putting these two thoughts together and asking, well, you know, what if we extended who you could donate sperm to outside of a known relationship.
It is different, though, than other kinds of donation, isn't it, Dr. Park? A donation of a kidney or a liver, that's to save somebody's life. This is qualitatively different.
You can already donate your corneas, which would, you know, help with somebody's sight, which, whilst that wouldn't save their life, it would make a huge difference to the quality of their life, and is obviously really very important to people. And it's the same with fertility. So people really care about being able to reproduce. They care about being able to have a family and the kind of family that they want. It's really central to how they see their lives. And not being able to do that causes a huge amount of suffering.
Dr. Kenold, it's about consent. If somebody were to agree to this included in all the other opt-in possibilities of donating heart, lungs and so on, if they said, yes, my sperm can be used in a fertility clinic, what's wrong with that?
I don't actually see a thing that's wrong with it. I think what the cornerstone is of modern medical ethics is consent, which is really just a mechanism by which we try to facilitate people's autonomy, which is living their lives and also having a say over their deaths and what happens after their death according to their own values.
And Dr. Parker, what's the evidence about how any of this affects the children who are the outcome of the process?
What we're suggesting has never been done before. So there isn't a system anywhere where men can donate their sperm to fertility clinics after they've died and for it to be used by strangers. So the honest answer is that we don't actually know what the effect would be, but we can infer what the effect would be from existing populations. So children who have been born from sperm used after the donor has died, as far as we know, don't suffer any ill health. Then the question is, well, what's going to be the effect on their mental health? And if you look at populations of people born from living sperm donors, what they say is that they're interested in knowing about the donor. So they want to know who they were and why they donated, but they don't want to have a relationship with them.
We do know a fair bit about this now, and what we've come to understand is that it's quite important for children to know their conception story as they're growing up. They accept it quite readily, and of course, you know, they're usually in families where the parents have gone to great effort to have them. So I think it's probably right to speculate that there would not be any serious harm such that you would rule it out. And I think it is important insofar as we can facilitate with an idea that it's unlikely to cause any kind of significant harm greater than the harm, which I don't really think there has been very much, of people being donor conceived.
Dr. Leslie Cannold there, and we also heard from Dr. Joshua Parker. Scientists here in Britain are to launch a satellite designed to measure the amount of light reflected off the Earth's surface. It'll be used to tie together the observations of all other satellites, past, present and future. The mission is called Truths, and our science correspondent Jonathan Amos told us about it.
So they want to get this very detailed picture of reflected light, and then they can use that to compare and contrast different satellites. Let me give you an example. There is a granddaddy mission called Landsat. Okay, this is really the grandfather of all Earth observation missions. And it's been going since the 1970s. And every time one satellite has come towards the end of its life, they've launched another one. And they've overlapped. And they've tried to do cross-calibration very successfully, actually, it has to be said. And they've gone through a whole series. I can't remember. I think they're up to 8 or 9 now. It's been going on since the 1970s. But think about it. Every time they've launched one of those satellites, although it's essentially the same camera in that satellite, the components have changed. Certain components are no longer available. So you go and get a new component to make your new camera. The things that those satellites see, they're never quite the same. You know, they look at a desert, they look at the Sahara, they don't quite see it the same way as the previous satellite did, or the satellite before that. Is there a way in which we can actually even out all of the uncertainties, the biases that exist in the vision systems of satellites, and say, yeah, absolutely, this is what you saw, and now I can see precisely how these things have changed?
And what will they do then with that knowledge?
We have computer models at the moment that look out into the future to try and tell us how the climate on Earth is going to change. And there's a lot of uncertainty. You know, you'll speak to scientists and you can ask them the question, well, how much is Earth going to warm if we put so much carbon dioxide into the atmosphere? And they don't say to you, by 2100, it'll be 2.2 degrees warmer than it is now. They say, well, anywhere between 1 and 3.5 degrees. It's a big uncertainty, OK? If we can take an absolute picture of planet Earth and the light that's coming off it, we'll get a signature of what the climate is doing. And we can repeat this experiment in 10, 15 years' time, and we'll be able to see absolutely that climate signature and how it's changed. And that'll help us refine those models.
That was Jonathan Amos. Now to a story about a dog and a bone. Nothing unusual about that, you might say, but what if the bone turns out to be 197 million years old? The story began when John Copsill took his dogs, Poppy and Sam, for a walk on the beach in Somerset in southwest England over the Christmas period. He told Lawrence Pollard what happened next.
Yeah, it's an area of beach that not many people really go to. I mean, I don't know if many people know, it actually has the second highest tidal range in the world at the Bristol Channel. So the tide goes out a long way. And obviously there's a lot of mud out there. But with the storms we had before Christmas, I kind of thought that storm will have washed some of the mud away. Let's go and have a look and see what we can find. Yeah. And as we were out playing on the rocks, playing with the ball, and Poppy was playing in the rock pool, Sam came running past me and looked at something on the ground. And I looked and thought, oh, my God, we have found it. And that was it. Well, there it was, just sat in front of me.
And it basically looks like, I don't know, the spine of an alien with some ribs. And it was, what was it?
It's kind of alien.
Yeah, exactly. So it's fixed in the rock. There it is. It's exposed. Yeah. And the dogs have just run past it. Did you know what it was straight away?
Well, I knew it was something. I knew it was something extremely special. I knew I'd found some fossilized sea creature of some description. Initially, when somebody spoke to me and said, how old do you think it is? My initial reaction was, well, it's at least 65 million years old. But since the Southwest Heritage team got involved and Natural England and the excavation process, etc., while they're excavating this, they reckon because of looking at the area of a rock around it and the other fossils embedded in the rock, it's somewhere in the region of 197 million years old.
My goodness. And what do they do with it? Do they then chop out the chunk of rock that it's in? What's happened to it?
Basically, yeah, it has been excavated. We dug up a hole all the way around it, levered it out, and managed to get it onto a pallet. And in Stalford, we've got the last, what they call mud horse fisherman in the world, who basically drives out across the rocks and scoots out across the mud on his little mud scooter and collects all his fish. But he's the man who drives out there. So, yeah, he helped us get the thing back in the back of his car. Otherwise, I don't know how we'd have carried it back.
And what has it turned out to be? It's turned out to be a previously unknown. And therefore, everyone wants to know, what's it going to be named new fossil?
It is an ichthyosaur. It's definitely an ichthyosaur, but there is a possibility it could be some subspecies. The idea of a new species was kind of a joke comment of mine that I said, if it's a new species, can I name it? And the paleontologist sort of said, well, yeah, that is the tradition. If somebody finds it, they name it. So I've decided that if it is a new species of ichthyosaur, it's got to be called a Poppy-Eye Samosaur.
Not a Sam-Eye Samosaur. Isn't Sam a bit upset about that?
Well, this is the problem.
That was John Copsill. And it is a beautiful winter's day for a walk on the beach with my dogs, Floyd and Pixel. Pixel, what have you found? Heavens. OK, I better go and get my shovel, but there will be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you would like to comment on this one or the topics we covered in it, send us an email, please. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Jackie Leonard. Until next time, goodbye.